of the Court of Appeals. We have two cases set for oral argument this morning. The first is People versus Piper. Council President Ready. We'll take that case first. Second case is O'Connell versus Biomet. Council President Ready in that case.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, we'll take that case second. I'm sure all of you have argued here before. Let me simply review the ground rules with you briefly. These cases are set for 15 minutes aside. You'll be guided by a lighting system on the podium, which works as follows. When your time commences, the light turns green. After 10 minutes have expired, the light will turn amber. And when your full 15 minutes have expired, the light will turn red. You'll be guided by the counter on the podium to indicate how much time you have left, since it counts backwards from 15. We've reviewed the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you've set them forth. So to the extent you want to proceed directly to argument without discussing the facts, that's fine with us, but the case is yours to argue as you wish. Judge Richmond reminds me that we're recording your arguments, and the recordings will be made available over the internet within a few days following today's argument. So, especially in dealing with child sexual assaults, please don't mention the child's name. I'm sure you understand that. You can adjust the podium by the use of a toggle switch. Feel free to move it upward and downward. We would ask you, however, to stay close to the podium, because if you stray from it, the recording will not pick up your voice. Finally, if anybody in the audience has a cell phone, a pager, or some similar device, please ensure it's turned off. We're ready for argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Elizabeth Griffin appearing on behalf of Paul Piper. Mr. Piper was charged with one count of sexual assault on a child position of trust against his girlfriend's child during a 13-and-a-half-month time span. During the dates charged, LB, which is what I'm calling the child, was 2.5 to 3.5 years old. The alleged outcry to her mom happened on the last date charged. The next day, she was examined by a doctor, and there were no signs of sexual abuse. 2 days later, LB was interviewed by a social worker. She was shown genitals on a drawing and asked repeatedly if Mr. Piper had touched her there. She denied this for over half an hour until she finally agreed. At the competency hearing, LB was 4.5. She was asked 30 times what Mr. Piper did to her, and she could not say. At trial, LB agreed that Mr. Piper made her mom sad, but could not say why. The prosecutor prompted her by saying, "Something happened to you?" And she said, "Yes, he touched me here, he touched me 2 times, here and here." And that was pretty much the substance of her trial testimony. She didn't know what he touched her with, she didn't remember telling the social worker this, and she didn't remember going to the doctor. Mr. Piper had the right to be presumed innocent unless the prosecution proved his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt by competent and admissible evidence. And the issues in this appeal implicate all of those rights. I'd like to start with the claim that the child was not competent to testify. LB, at the competency hearing, was unable to describe or relate the events respecting which she was examined, which is what is required by the plain language of the statute. She also could not accurately recollect and narrate the events of abuse, which is what our Supreme Court has said is specifically required in cases of sex assault on a child. So it's really straightforward. That by itself compelled a finding of incompetency in this case.
Counsel, there seems to be some debate. The court said that the child was not asked about the actual assault. Would you address that, please?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the court apparently had forgotten. I mean, it's clear that the court was wrong, and the reason the court was wrong, I don't know. But the court had delayed its ruling, and so most likely the court had forgotten what happened, because immediately after the hearing, the court actually said, well, the child couldn't tell us anything about the nitty-gritty of the offense. And then later, when the court issued the written ruling, it was based on an inaccurate understanding of what had happened at the hearing, because the court seemed to think that neither attorney had tried to ask the child about what happened to her and the reason that she was there, and that is simply wrong.
And how is it wrong?
because the prosecutor asked her 28 questions about what Mr. Pfeiffer did to make her mommy sad, why was he in jail, why was he in trouble, why was mommy sad, repeatedly over and over, and the child kept saying she didn't know or because. She simply couldn't answer the question. And when she was asked things like, did he make you sad, did he hurt you, she said no.
If the child did not or was not able to answer it at the competency hearing, but was able to answer it at trial, does that make a difference?
It doesn't, because the ruling is required to be made at the time on the evidence that's before the court at the time, as with any pretrial ruling. And in addition, Judge, it seems pretty clear in this case that something happened between the competency hearing and the trial, most likely some kind of coaching, because this child was in court and repeatedly asked these questions without a jury, without all the pressures of the trial, and was completely unable to answer. And a short time later, she was given this prompting question by the prosecutor and gave her robotic immediate response to that question. So I think the clear implication is that there was some coaching in between.
If there, assuming for a minute that she could be there and testify, if there was coaching, then that's the kind of thing you would handle on cross-examination, isn't it?
Well, sure, if there had been coaching before the competency hearing, perhaps. But what we have here is we have a showing at the time of the competency hearing that, as a matter of fact, this child either had no recollection or it never happened. She couldn't say anything that happened to her. So we've established that at this point in time, shortly before the trial. And when we've got that situation, and then later at the trial, she's saying, oh, yes, he touched me here, he touched me here, but, well, I don't remember anything else. I don't remember going to the doctor. I don't remember talking to the social worker. You know, the fact that she's been later coached to say these things doesn't override what's been established at the hearing. And what's been established at the hearing is that she can't say anything that happened to her. And you might have a different case. Now, I would still argue you can't rely on the trial testimony if that was all you had. But if that was all you had, you know, that would be a different situation. Here you've got, you know, we're stuck with what happened at the competency hearing, and that's what we know about the child, and the child can't answer any questions. I'm sorry.
Let me ask, assuming again for a minute that the court heard with regard at the competency hearing, does the child's ability to answer the questions at the trial render any error harmless?
It can't, Judge, because the cases say that this court, the appellate court, has to review trial court rulings based on the record that was in front of the court at the time.
What case says that?
The Bowers case.
That's a different statute, though. That's under the child hearsay statute.
That's right.
And, of course, the suppression cases say that. But I didn't find any case specifically under the competency statute that says we're limited to the evidence presented at the competency hearing. There isn't
such a case. I don't think there is in Colorado, and I guess it hasn't come up. But, I mean, I think by analogy, the same principle applies. And in the Moody case, the Supreme Court was really clear about the rationale for that. And that is fairness, that when there's a hearing taken up on a particular issue, that's when the parties are addressing that issue, and that's when that issue is resolved. And then you move on from there. There's some finality in that ruling. There's not some sort of a secret revisiting of it later when nobody knows that that's what's happening.
The competency finding does not have to be made at a pretrial hearing. It was done here, I guess, a day or two before the trial. It was only a couple days before the trial, as I understand. But the judge did find the child competent. And don't we review that for an abuse of discretion?
I think that's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And the judge tried, at least he certainly was aware of the statute. And you're saying there was no evidence at the competency hearing that the child could relate the events of the offense. But doesn't the Trujillo case say that that's not necessary? And aren't you asking us to disregard the Trujillo case?
No, Judge, because really, you know, that's kind of a collateral issue in this case, because the child wasn't able to answer the questions she was asked in this case. I mean, I would like for you to say Trujillo was wrong. And I think you could in the context of this case, because that was part of the court's ruling. But you don't need to, because in this case, the child was asked 30 questions about what Mr. Pfeiffer did. How did he make your mom sad? Why was he in jail? Why was he in trouble? And she couldn't say. So she couldn't answer the questions that she was asked.
Well, wait a second. The statute says she has to be able to describe in language appropriate for a child of that age events or facts respecting which she is examined.
Exactly.
And she did answer questions in language that the judge found appropriate about topics that she was asked. She did not directly answer questions about the alleged offense. And you're contending that she did not relate in language appropriate to a child answers to questions she was asked?
Yes.
So we can review the record. All right, but the judge obviously found that she did. So
have to remember, when you're reviewing the court's ruling, you've got to remember the fact that the judge didn't remember what happened at the hearing at all, because I guess maybe you and I have a disagreement about whether she was asked about the events of the abuse, because I think that she was. I think it's pretty clear that she was, and apparently you don't. But the court seemed to think she wasn't asked any questions about what had happened. And if you look at the 30 questions that I set forth in my brief, and a lot of them are in bold, I think those are questions, those are trying to get at, what did Mr. Pfeiffer do? What did he do? What did he do? And she kept saying, because, I don't know, mommy's sad. That's what the DA was trying to get at, obviously, Judge. And if the statute requires the child to be able to answer the questions that she's asked and testify about the events that she's asked about, that wasn't satisfied here. Sure, she could answer some of the questions. And maybe you don't have to ask her about the abuse. I think you do. But even if you don't, they asked her 30 questions that she was not able to answer, and they were the questions that mattered. About my client was being tried for an offense that was going to put him away for life in prison if he was convicted, and this little girl had no idea what happened to her, if anything.
Is there a difference between an inability to answer and an unwillingness to answer? I mean, one way to interpret the questions that you're pointing to is that she was unable. She just simply could not describe what happened to her. Or allegedly happened to her. Or the other way to interpret them is that she didn't want to talk about it.
Well, we don't inquire into that. I mean, the fact of the matter is that in order to convict somebody of a crime and put them in prison, we have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and we have to have competent testimony. And if a person can't or won't testify and say what happened, then they're not competent. And the court didn't make a finding that she couldn't do it, and it doesn't appear that she was emotionally unable to. I mean, I don't think there's any indication of that in the record. She was speaking, she was answering questions, she wasn't crying. It wasn't a case where she broke down and couldn't look at the defendant or something like that. She just didn't know.
Are you aware of any cases in which a four-year-old's been ruled competent to testify?
I'm not aware of any. But in addition to the fact that she couldn't answer these 30 questions, she was confused about some important concepts, lying and what's wrong. And she gave a lot of inaccurate responses, and she contradicted herself, and she was really easily led. I mean, one of the most important series of questions that happened during this competency hearing was the prosecutor asking her, are you five? And she's not, she's four. And she says, no, I'm four. And then again, are you five? Yes, I'm five. I mean, that's what happened in the social services interview. When they didn't like the answer they got, they kept asking her, and she's a little child. She wants to please adults and make the questioning stop too. And so she gives them the answer that they want, and that's where this little girl is coming from. And that's just not reliable testimony.
Well, the trial judge made findings in his order. Now, you're saying that those findings are erroneous, or you're saying that he abused discretion in the conclusion he made based on those findings?
Both.
So when he found that the child could relate her name, her age, other things you would expect from a three-year-old girl, you're saying that those are findings of facts. How are we supposed to overturn those?
Well, I mean, for one thing, she can't relay her age. So that one's easy, right?
She recognized the defendant and identified him by name and nickname. That did happen at the hearing, yes?
Yes.
She was articulate, precocious for age. That's an observation the judge made, and we're supposed to go behind that?
Yes. You are a reviewing court. I mean, you have a job here. Sure, it's abuse of discretion standard. You have to defer to the finding of fact if they're supported by the record, but you don't get to just throw up your hands.
All right, so you're saying those are clearly erroneous findings, and that's what you want us to look
at? Some of those findings are clearly erroneous. Not every finding. I mean, sure, she was able to say her name. She was able to say the judge didn't have purple hair. You know, frankly, I don't find that to be very impressive. That doesn't require any memory. That doesn't require any interpretation of what's happening. That's something that everyone can see is the case. I mean, I think it's unpleasant in a case with allegations like this, but you have a job as a reviewing court to look at the evidence and see if it's reliable and if it's good enough to put somebody away for life. And it wasn't here. Unless there's more questions about that, I'd like to move on. Ooh, do I have 30 seconds left? I'm going to save that for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. My name is Rhonda White, attorney registration number 35996, and I represent the people in this matter. I'd like to address the first part of the defendant's first issue, that the trial court erred in finding that the victim, LB, was competent to testify at trial. Before discussing the language and application of the statute, section 139106, I would like to briefly address the defendant's assertion that the trial court erred in faulting the defense with not proving incompetency. As applicable to 139106, because a witness is presumed competent to testify, the opponent bears the burden to establish incompetency by clear and convincing evidence. The trial court here actually relieved the defendant of his burden to establish incompetency because it made the prosecution establish competency. Further, the trial court's determination that LB was competent necessarily means that the defendant would be unable to prove that LB was incompetent. Under 1390-106-1B2, a child under the age of 10 is competent to testify when he or she is able to describe or relate in language appropriate for a child of that age the events or facts respecting which the child is examined. The defendant asserts that People v. District Court of El Paso and People v. District Court in and for Summit County stand for the proposition that the trial witness must be examined about the facts of the abuse. In District Court of El Paso, the trial court ruled that the 4-year-old was incompetent because the child was unresponsive to questions. When later discussing whether the victim's out-of-court statement would be admissible, the Supreme Court stated as follows. A competency hearing determines only whether a child can accurately recollect at trial the events of abuse, not whether the child was competent when the hearsay statement was made. In District Court in and for Summit County...
Do you submit that she was asked questions at this competency hearing about the events, alleged events of abuse?
I don't submit that.
Answer those questions, did she?
Well, I think that...
Well, what does that have to do with anything here?
Exactly. I'm trying to say that in District Court of Summit County, there was a 4-year-old that was determined to be competent. And the Supreme Court reiterated that principle. However, in People v. Trujillo, this court specifically looked at those two Supreme Court cases and said that the description of the assault isn't required.
Well, Ms. Griffin seems to concede that for purposes of this argument, we don't have to deal with that Trujillo issue. She's accepting that for now.
Okay.
But what she's telling us is that the child could not describe in age-appropriate language events, cannot describe events or facts, cannot tell her age, cannot do that. Do we go behind those findings? And
I disagree with that. I think that here the child was asked about broad concepts and was not precisely asked about the abuse. And both the prosecution defense counsel asked general questions, even though either side had the ability to more directly question LB and directly push her on any issue, including any questions that they wanted to.
Well, Ms. White, how do you characterize the questions she was asked?
I think that those are general questions. I don't think they were questions about the abuse. If you look at them,
wasn't the prosecutor trying to get to that, though, by the method of his questioning?
Not necessarily. I think it's a strategy decision. I mean, you're looking at whether or not they're competent. We don't have to look at the events of the abuse. So in order...
But if the prosecutor does ask about it and she can't respond...
Right.
I mean, is the disagreement here whether she was examined about the events of the abuse or not? Is that where the dispute is?
I don't think that's the dispute. I would state that she wasn't specifically asked about the events of abuse. If you look at the list of questionings, you're looking at a four-year-old here, and she's asked if her mom was sad. How was her mom sad? Well, that's not specifically asking.
Let me. Counsel, the prosecutor asked, what did he do? Do you remember what he did?
Mm-hmm.
How did he do that? Do you remember what happened? Do you know how he did that? Repeatedly, what did he do, as opposed to why was your mom sad? Repeatedly, what did he do?
But I still think that those are general questions. That's not specifically stating, he did this to you. What did he do to you? This is general, broad concepts, and that's all that we need to determine competency. We don't need her. I mean, she answered the questions as the trial court determined. I mean, she answered pretty clearly with respect to what she was examined. And I think if you look at the trial court findings, again, she did know and relate her name and age. She answered the questions to the trial court satisfaction that she was competent at that time. And I think the trial court, you know, as it determined that Elvie was direct, answered responsibly, she consistently and adamantly did not corrected false assertions and had the ability to deal with truth and lies. And that's what we're looking for at the competency hearing. And the trial court stated that it had enough information to make its determination based upon what the child was actually examined about at the hearing. So therefore, I don't think that anything that she talks about showed that she was unable to relate to the questions asked.
Let me ask again, though. Assuming that that's correct, what she testified about at the hearing was that her mother was sad.
Mm-hmm.
But she was asked repeatedly, why is your mother sad? And she couldn't answer.
But I think that if you look at the context of when it was happening, those questions were happening in succession. And I think that when you ask a four-year-old, why is your mom sad? I mean, that's not asking specific enough about the events of the abuse.
But it was a follow-up response to her own testimony.
Right.
My mother made my mother sad.
Right.
So the prosecutor is following up, trying to probe that and find out why.
Exactly.
It wasn't a question that the prosecutor first formulated and said, defendant made your mother sad, didn't he?
Right, but I think that that is a great answer as to why she did relate to those questions. I mean, she was able to state things that he had done. He made my mom sad. He did this. He went to jail. And although she wasn't able to further answer that question, I think that that's enough. And I think that when you're looking at a four-year-old, that's enough in relation to an alleged abuse. I think that should be responsive enough to a question. And further, defense counsel didn't ask any further questions about any of the details of the offense, and they had the ability to do that. But I think that based on the questions asked, she was properly determined to be competent.
Counsel, if she had come to trial and said that same information, would that be sufficient to establish the offense charged?
No, but I think if you look at the trial testimony, there's no indication, and the defense doesn't assert that she was unable to relate to the events of abuse at trial. And that was only a few days before. The competency hearing was a couple days before the trial. So I think if she would have been asked about the abuse in more specific details, like you would ask a four-year-old, I think she would have answered correctly, but I don't think that we need that in order to establish competency. Therefore, the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it found Elvie competent to testify. I would like to briefly address the defendant's assertion about that the trial court erred by admitting the evidence of the defendant's prior conviction to impeach his hearsay statements. First, the denials were not hearsay. I think that the hearsay rule applies to defendants who elect not to testify at trial, but introduce their own statements through another witness. Here, I think the statements were admitted for the truth of the matter asserted, the substance of the statement being that the defendant denied the allegations. These statements were offered to show that the defendant continually denied the offense, which was a direct inference to show that he was innocent, and therefore went to the truth of the matter asserted. I think the impeachment was permissible because the prosecution chose to redact the denials.
You're saying that the statement of the defendant that came through the declarant was offered for the truth of the matter?
Absolutely, yes.
So therefore it was hearsay, wasn't it?
Yes, they were hearsay. And that's why this was the defense elicited the self-serving hearsay, and therefore he was able to be impeached by the prior conviction.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. The defendant's solicitation of that?
Yes.
Okay.
But the prosecution chose to redact the defendant's denials, and this was proper because the defendant's statements were self-serving hearsay, and it was defense counsel's strategy decision whether to admit those statements knowing about the prior conviction. Further, the jury received a limiting instruction that a prior conviction is one factor that the jury could consider in determining the credibility of the declarant, and the prosecution repeatedly stated that the defendant's prior conviction could be considered only when evaluating his credibility and not for his propensity. The trial court properly admitted evidence of the defendant's prior conviction because the defendant elicited self-serving hearsay statements. Finally, the defendant argues that the prosecutor committed prosecutorial misconduct during closing argument. The defendant asserts that the prosecutor committed several types of misconduct in closing argument by giving his personal belief that the victim was telling the truth, allying with the jury, and impermissibly shifting the burden of proof. However, in making a closing argument, a prosecutor may properly include the facts admitted into evidence and any reasonable inference within, and this includes reasonable inferences about the truthfulness of a witness's testimony, which is what happened here. Additionally, it was well established that use of the first person does not constitute a personal expression of the defendant's guilt. And further, none of the prosecutor's arguments suggested that the prosecution was relieved of proving all of the elements of the crime charged and did not shift the burden. The prosecutor was simply pointing out that in child sex assault cases, we don't always have the perfect witnesses, and therefore, proper inferences from the evidence presented would have to be made. Therefore, there was no prosecutorial misconduct. However, even if there was error, any error was not flagrant or tremendously improper. And therefore, it was not plain error. If there are no further questions, the people would respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's conviction.
I have a question, sir, about an item that hasn't been mentioned yet, and that's the admission at trial of the videotape that was made of LB.
The out-of-court statements?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Under the child hearsay statute, are you taking the position that it was admissible because she testified at the proceeding?
Well, I think that, first of all, it's admissible because it's a prior consistent statement, and her credibility was attacked generally. But secondly, because she was properly...
So it's not hearsay at all, you're saying?
That's my first
argument,
yes.
So and then, it's not hearsay at all, we don't even worry about...
Right, the child hearsay statute doesn't apply.
Okay.
And then secondly, because she was deemed...
Wait a minute.
Sure.
Slow down. Just the sequence of events. I can't tell from the briefs, and I have to admit, I haven't read all the transcript, but after the child testified, was she cross-examined by the, I assume she was cross-examined by the defendant, and they attacked her credibility?
To my recollection. I haven't.
And then the videotape was played after that?
I actually don't recall. I haven't seen the record in some time.
Because my concern is, you see, if that wasn't a sequence of events, how can we say it was offered as non-hearsay to rebut as a prior consistent statement?
Right, and I think that the alternative argument is because she did testify at trial, she was able to be cross-examined, so the admission of that, if it would be hearsay under the child hearsay.
Then we have to go to the child hearsay statute.
Right. Right.
So here's my question. Where did the judge ever make a finding before it was admitted that the statement had sufficient safeguards of reliability? The statute requires that, does it not?
From my recollection, I recall that they did make that specific finding, but I would have to defer to the record because I haven't.
So the prosecutor seemed to think he was offering it under the child hearsay statute because he requested that finding or the court made
it? I think so.
Right.
Yes.
But is an alternative, if she was cross-examined, it could come in as a prior consistent statement to support. Okay.
That would be. We would ask that this court affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
On that last question, the court did not find the out-of-court statements reliable, and the reason was that the prosecution decided we don't need the child hearsay statute because now you've found the child competent, she's going to testify, and we're just going to bring it in under other theories. So that finding was never made.
Do you attack that as being an improper ruling? Proper admission of the video?
Yes.
Why wasn't it appropriately admitted as to bolster her statements? Prior consistent statement.
Well, if you look at the second part of my competency argument, what I say is if the child is incompetent, then by necessity it was error to Right. And then I also say that it violated due process and...
I understand, okay.
Because it was unreliable. The statements were unreliable. So that's where I address that. I guess I'm out of time, so I will just ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. Case will stand submitted. We'll get your written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can be prepared at counsel table, we'll...